listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And a lot going on. Edward Markey, the, what, almost 16 years, I believe 15 years, he's been in the House of Representatives, representing the great state of Massachusetts, won the primary yesterday. He is going to face off against a Republican, to Mr. Gomez, to fill the seat left empty by John Kerry, who has gone off to be Secretary of State, and who in a week or so is going off to Moscow. That should be interesting. So we'll see where that goes. The Markey campaign said Republicans are looking for the second coming of Scott Brown. Instead, they got Gabriel Gomez, a pro-life Republican who is a spokesman for a super PAC that attacked President Obama over the killing of Osama bin Laden. I think, frankly, though, the Republicans' hope is that the guy's name is Gabriel Gomez. Like, this is the Republicans' idea of being inclusive, is get people with ethnic names. They think Ted Cruz might win the presidency because Cruz sounds like it's Hispanic. I'm serious. I read this morning in Politico. It's like this is the Republicans' idea. In any case, I continue to be impressed by Pope Francis. I have long been a fan of many aspects of the Catholic Church. There are some areas where I disagree with their politics and their theology, but there are many more where I agree. And I think that this statement that he made, you know, his refusal to wear the ermine covered gown, basically, when he was first introduced to the world as the Pope, instead of just a simple cassock, if that's the correct pronunciation. I'm not Catholic, so I always screw these words up. I'm sorry, but he came out as a simple man. His washing the feet of people who aren't even who are Muslims, of women. I mean, this is big deal stuff. But this is incredible. Listen to this. This is the Pope earlier today giving a speech on, he spoke to a group and he had, this is Vatican Radio reported this. But here's what the Pope said, and I am quoting. This was at a private mass. He said, a headline that really struck me on the day of the tragedy, he's talking in Bangladesh, we're talking about that factory that collapsed, that had several thousand, 2,000-3,000 people in it, over 300 dead. He said, a headline that really struck me on the day of the tragedy in Bangladesh was living on 38 euros a month. Now, that's, I'm quoting the Pope, and that's the Pope quoting a headline. The Pope continues in his Mass, Pope Francis says, that is what the people who died were being paid. This is called slave labor. Today in the world, this slavery is being committed against something beautiful that God has given us, the capacity to create, to work, to have dignity. How many brothers and sisters find themselves in this situation? Exclamation point. Not paying fairly. Not giving a job because you are only looking at balance sheets, only looking at how to make a profit. That goes against God! Exclamation point. End of quote from Pope Francis. Our quote for the day. Happy May Day, by the way, speaking of labor and laborers. May Day is, traditionally kind of the International Labor Day, in addition to the, one of the major pagan festivals. There's a lot of cool stuff. It's kind of May 1st as the unofficial beginning of kind of spring, summer, whatever. You know, having grown up in Michigan and lived in New Hampshire and Vermont where, spring is really not. You don't really know it's there until May 1st. In fact, one year when we were living in New Hampshire, we were living on this lake, Stinson Lake, and when Louise and I were running the Community for Abused Kids, and Mike had this, who ran the general store, Mike and Ray Dune, had this you know, jar where you put a buck into the jar and bet on the day that the ice is going to, the ice is going to melt on the lake. And I bet my birthday, which is May 7th, and I just gave it away, didn't I? I shouldn't have done that. Well, it's on the Wikipedia page. I mean, what can you do? In any case, I bet my birthday, and that was the day the ice melted, you know. So anyhow, I think of May as the, so happy May 1st, happy May Day. Here's something I find fascinating. And, you know, I'm wondering, it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out. You know, Stephen Colbert's sister, Elizabeth Colbert Bush, unfortunate last name, at least it's spelled, you know, with a C in there. No relation to the Bush family. This is more like the Anheuser-Busch spelling rather than the Prescott Bush Nazi supporter warmonger spelling. In any case, Elizabeth Colbert Bush is running against Mark Sanford in South Carolina, and apparently a push poll is going on. And the Center for American Progress's Think Progress blog is asking people to send, if you're now, and so I, let me pass this along to you. If you happen to be one of the people who is watching us on Free Speech TV or any of the cable systems that carry us as television in South Carolina on Dish Network, on DirecTV, if you happen to be listening on Sirius XM in South Carolina, if you happen to be listening on any of the Pacifica or nonprofit stations, I don't believe we're on any commercial stations in South Carolina, but we are on a lot of outlets in South Carolina. And so if you happen to be listening to the program in any of those, tips at thinkprogress.org is the email address if you got one of these calls. They're trying to determine if this is a very small and isolated phenomenon where they're trying to figure out how to do a push poll or whether this is an actual push poll underway. Now, let me give you a little background. So here's what's going on. Is people are calling up, it appears to be, somebody is calling mostly registered Democratic women and asking them questions. Would you support Elizabeth Colbert Bush, or Colbert, I guess is how she says it, would you support her if you knew that? And then after the word that, there's a bunch of things that actually aren't true. But since they're asking the question, they're not making an assertion, right? That she'd had an abortion, that she'd done jail time, that she was caught running up a charge account bill, that she was held in contempt of court at her divorce proceedings, that she supported a failed stimulus plan, that unions contributed to her campaign. And, you know, none of this stuff, well, I don't know, maybe the unions have helped her, but none of this stuff is true. So, and the people calling won't tell the callers who they are calling for. So we thought of, you know, well, what if you were to call a Republican women and say, would you be less likely to vote for Mark Sanford if I told you that he was arrested for the criminal offense of trespassing? If he was facing contempt of court charges in his divorce case? If he disappeared for a week while he was governor, leaving no one to run the state of South Carolina? Would you still vote for Mark Sanford if I told you that he hid out in Argentina with his mistress for days and days or weeks and weeks of wild sex and lied to his staff about his whereabouts? What if I told you Mark Sanford used state funds to disappear to a foreign country? Actually, we don't know how wild the sex was. We should probably tone that one down. What if I told you that he professed to the world that a woman other than his wife was his soulmate? Actually, these are all true. That's only half the list.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So does Elizabeth Colbert Bush have the basis for a slander lawsuit since these are untrue? And how's Stephen Colbert going to handle this? This is going to be fascinating. Welcome back to Harder for Your Brain. The Tom Hartman Program does not, however, lead to stiff thinking. What if I told you that Mark Sanford has been arrested for the criminal offense of trespassing? Now, you know, is this a push poll? If you call up Republican voters in South Carolina and ask them these questions, You know, right now, apparently a negative push poll is going on in South Carolina targeting Democratic female women, Democratic women voters. And if you happen to be one, by the way, send an email to tips@thinkprogress.org and let them know. And in fact, give us a call. I'd love to hear from you if you've gotten one of these push poll calls where they're saying, would you be more or less likely to support Elizabeth Colbert Bush if you knew that, she had been convicted of, blowing up a bus? Or would you be more likely to vote or less likely to vote for Elizabeth Colbert Bush if you were to discover that she was secretly the third wife of Osama bin Laden? Would you be more or less likely to vote for Elizabeth Colbert Bush if you were to discover that she's actually the vice premier of Burma? I mean, whatever. I mean, I'm pulling stuff. Okay, so, I mean, you know, in other words, they're calling up and they're throwing lies at people. They're saying, would you be more, but they're lies that, well, maybe you could believe that. She had an abortion. She had a divorce. She had, things like, well, she didn't. But, you know, they're saying these things. So, what if we did a push poll? What if we did a poll? I don't even think this is a push poll. I think that Elizabeth Colbert Bush has a legal basis for a slander lawsuit against this polling company, except they can't figure out who it is because it comes in as a blocked call, and the people who are calling won't tell the people that they're talking to who they are or where they're from. But like I said, if you got one of the calls, you know, let us know if you happen to be in South Carolina. And what if we were to be calling South Carolina registered Republicans and saying, particularly Republican women, and saying, you know, what if I told you that Mark Sanford, who's the nominee for Senate, going to run in the special election, or excuse me, House of Representatives, going to run in the special election. If I told you that Mark Sanford has been arrested for the criminal offense of trespassing, what if I told you that Mark Sanford is facing contempt of court charges in his divorce case? This happens to be true, by the way. What if I told you Mark Sanford disappeared for a week while he was governor, leaving no one to run the state of South Carolina? What if I told you Mark Sanford hid out in Argentina with his mistress and lied to even his own staff, and of course to his wife, about his whereabouts, not to mention to all the people in South Carolina? What if I told you that Mark Sanford used state funds to disappear to a foreign country? Would you be more or less likely to vote for him for the House of Representatives? What if I told you that Mark Sanford professed to the world that a woman other than his wife was his soulmate while he was still bound by the sacrament of marriage under the rules of the Holy Bible? That's how you'd phrase it in South Carolina. What if I told you that Mark Sanford refused to spend Father's Day with his own children? Now, these are all true things. Is this a push poll? No, I don't think this is a push poll. I think would you be more or less likely to vote for Mark Sanford if I told you that the Republican Party began the process of impeachment against Mark Sanford, which would have removed him from office for multiple ethical violations against the people of the state of South Carolina? The Republican Party actually started the process of impeachment. What if I told you, would you be more or less likely? Now, this is a question you don't want to be calling men in South Carolina asking them this question. Just women, right? What if I told you one of Mark Sanford's most well-known supporters is Larry Flint, owner and publisher of the adult magazine Hustler? Yes, Larry Flint has come out and endorsed Mark Sanford because Mark Sanford has openly repudiated family values by virtue of his actions. And Larry Flint is not a big fan of family values, at least as defined by the whole bunch on the Pat Robertson bunch. What if I told you that multiple media outlets have recorded video of Mark Sanford arguing with himself in public? Would you be more or less likely to vote for him? So, Anyhow, that push-pull is not happening. I think it should, but it's not happening. Okay, so a public figure, this, thanks Sean for the, or Shano for this, 1964 U.S. Supreme Court case, New York Times versus Sullivan, a public figure, Elizabeth Colbert Bush, is a public figure. Is, you know, is this push-pull that's going on where they're calling women in South Carolina and asking them, and how would you respond if you got one of these calls? Have you ever got a push-pull call? How would you respond? How have you responded to a push-pull call? You know, like where they say, you know, would you be more or less likely to vote for Elizabeth Colbert Bush if you were to discover that from the time she was 13 until she was 24, she was a member of the Nazi Party and every week used a machine gun. All right, something. I mean, you know, whatever. It's like you're just making stuff up. Anyhow, the public figure must prove an additional element. This is for defamation. And that is actual malice. This seems malicious to me. Okay, meanwhile, probably the most important piece of news that's out today is in the New York Times. The headline is Banks Resist Strict Controls of Foreign Bets. I want to share that with you when we come back. You know, along with your calls about push polls and things like that. And by the way, the president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, got arrested in Iran by his own people. Things are getting weird.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And they've arrested three new suspects in Boston. We're going to get to that. We'll have a report from Boston on that as we continue through the program. Stick around. 28 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I promised you I would tell you about this the issue with the banksters this is interesting. We've got a live report about May Day in Seattle from Mark Taylor Canfield. James got a push poll in Arkansas. There's some interesting calls here, but we'll get to those in just a second. This is the Eric Lipton, who writes on these topics a lot for the New York Times, writing in today's New York Times, or perhaps yesterday's actually. It's dated April 30th. The headline, Banks Resist Strict Controls of Foreign Bets. Now, there's a couple of numbers you need to know to put this stuff in context. The first is that the gross domestic product, the total sum of all the economic activity in the United States, is in the neighborhood of $15 trillion a year. 15. Just put that money, that number in your brain, that amount of money. $15 trillion a year. That's everything. About 20% of that is government activity. The rest of it's private sector activity. And, you know, that's our GDP. About 20% of it is actually healthcare expenses. About 24% of it is banking. It's bizarre. You know, 9% manufacturing. I mean, we can break it out. But $15 trillion, that's the GDP of the United States. The GDP of the entire planet Earth is about $65 trillion a year. Okay, that's the U.S. and Europe and China and Russia and South Africa. Actually the entire continent of Europe, the entire continent of Asia, South America, Central America, North America, Australia. Total, $65 trillion a year. Simple numbers to remember, 15 and 65, okay? Now, knowing that, and knowing, by the way, that prior to Wendy Graham, who was on the board of Enron and good buddies with Ken Lay, prior to her husband, Phil Graham, the former Republican senator, pushing through the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, the number of dollars that was out there in a gray, unregulated marketplace of what are called derivatives, bets on bets and bets on bets on bets on bets, that had to do with things that were not actual commodities, that were not, you know, like wheat or oil or things, but instead were bets on financial instruments like mortgages. The total amount prior to Graham Leach Bliley was zero. 13 years ago, zero. Okay. So now we have three numbers to remember. $15 trillion, the GDP of the United States. $65 trillion, the GDP of the planet. Total number of derivatives of bets. Zero. Now, let me share with you the first two sentences of Eric Lipton's article in today's New York Times. With the headline, Banks Resist Strict Controls of Foreign Bets. Wall Street bankers and some of the world's top finance ministers are waging a bitter international war to block Washington financial regulators from extending their policing powers far beyond the nation's shores. The effort centered on oversight of the $700 trillion marketplace of the financial instruments known as derivatives. Are you listening to this? This is today's New York Times. You want to crash the world economy? The GDP of the entire United States, $15 trillion. The GDP of the entire planet, $65 trillion. The amount of derivatives out there from the founding of our republic until about 10 years ago, zero. The effort centered on an oversight of the $700 trillion marketplace of the financial instruments known as derivatives is just one front in a battle still being waged nearly 3 years after Congress passed the Dodd-Frank law, which revamped financial regulations in the United States in the hope of curtailing the risky trading practices blamed for the global financial crisis in 2008. In other words, they're back. I mean, this is a real battle. And Gary Gensler, who is the chairman of the agency that had, you know, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which has the power to oversee this, or was given the power. Actually, they had no power to oversee this prior to the passage of Dodd-Frank, which is how it got so big and how it blew up during the Bush administration. Almost all of this happened during the Bush administration. And Gary Gensler was given the power to oversee this by Dodd-Frank. Congress has been refusing to fund a staff for him in a way that he could really do the job. But he's still trying to push these regulations out. And he's trying to say that any bank anywhere in the world that is involved in trading derivatives with a counterparty in the United States, with a bank in the United States, with an individual in the United States, if anybody who is a party to one of these transactions that involves this $700 trillion worth of bets on bets on bets on phony baloney stuff. Nobody's manufacturing anything. Adam Smith is rolling in his grave. Gary Gensler is trying to promote a rule that would say if anywhere in the world this happens, the United States Commodities Futures Trading Commission, his agency, has some oversight over it. And the principal piece of that oversight would be to make it transparent. J.P. Morgan Chase, we just discovered now, as a result of Dodd-Frank, is sitting on $70 trillion worth of these things. That's with a T, $70 trillion. The GDP of the entire world all year is $65 trillion. The GDP of the United States, $15 trillion. J.P. Morgan Chase sitting on $70 trillion of them, according to this article in the New York Times. This is pretty amazing. The leading critic of Mr. Gensler's plan is Scott Garrett, congressman from New Jersey, Republican from New Jersey. Again, quoting from the New York Times, Mr. Garrett has collected more than $535,000 in contributions from investment banks and security companies in the last election cycle, behind only Speaker John Boehner and Majority Leader Eric Cantor in the House. Who do these guys work for? They work for the banksters. This is just incredible. I encourage you to read the article. I'm not going to go through the whole thing with you, but just, you know, what it is. This is why I wrote the book, The Crash of 2015, which will be out this November. I probably shouldn't be promoting it so heavily right now because you can't even pre-buy it or anything, but. Because the problem has not been fixed. And to the extent that the Obama administration has done things to fix the problem, the Republicans have refused to fund them and have blocked them at every turn. Okay, push polls. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve, you got a push poll?
Yeah, I got one of those push polls. It was for my Muslim representative is David Ramadan. He's a really good guy.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like push polling me. Did you know that David Ramadan was a retired suicide bomber?
Really? Is he actually a Muslim?
Yeah, he's actually a Muslim. He's from Beirut. And I kind of was drawn into him because one of the most honorable people that I, you know, was a contractor, one of the most honorable people that did some condominiums in Paul's Church was in fact a man from Beirut.
Yeah. So what? How did you respond to this push poll?
And it wasn't quite that ridiculous, but I mean, they just went on and on about he's an Arab terrorist, and you know, on and you know, just ridiculous stuff like
yeah.
that.
Muslim fear baiting.
Yeah. Well, in other words, they would make statements, and of course, the first part of the statement would be true, and the second part would be a lie. And I'd say, well, do you know that the second part of your question is a lie? And you know, they're not really what you would call, you know, dealing with a full deck when you're getting these push polls. So I'd say, well, this is why that's not true, you know, and I would explain it to them, and they would like, well, can you tell me who wrote this question? Well, I can't tell you until the survey's over. Of course,
yeah.
That was a lie.
Yeah.
So it was just interesting the way that these things come down and, you know, frustrating, I guess, is the best.
Yeah, it really is. And one of the sad things is that the person who's calling you and push-pulling you with these lies typically is some poor schlub who's being paid $8 or $10 an hour to make phone calls, you know?
From Washington State.
From Washington State. Yeah, I mean, they've hired some telemarketing company that might otherwise be calling and, you know, calling a list of women who have bought nylon panties or something and said, you know, we got a new no-run hose, would you like, you know, or something. Whatever. I thought of that because when I was 16, I actually used to do telemarketing for 2 months. I sold those. I sold nylon hose and I sold light bulbs to people over the telephone. So it's just some schlub, you know. It's just somebody making minimum wage, who's, you know, just or it could be some volunteer in a, you know, in a boiler room who's, you know. But generally, I think that they would not do that because they would, you know. But in any case, it's very strange. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Very interesting. Push polls, the strangest thing going. It's going to be really interesting to see how Stephen Colbert handles this one, because there's really, this could be very tricky.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Because if he mentions the lies that they're saying about his sister, then that puts those lies out there. I think he should be making stuff up about Mark Sanford, but then you don't have to make things up. Welcome back, 10 minutes before the hour, and the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. No way. James in Leslie, Arkansas. Hey, James, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, my brother. How are you this evening?
I am great, but I'll get better.
We suspect that, as you describe it, a push poll, that it was a robocall.
In Arkansas?
We for the first time in since 100 years ago, have majority Republicans in our House and mm-hmm. our representative, you know, and also the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a Democratic governor. It's the end of his legal term length. And we have two supposed Republicans and two Democrats that have thrown the hats in the ring.
Mm-hmm.
And in that Republican poll, or I call it that because it starts out with if you have a chance to vote for, gives you the names, and if you punch in, which my favorite is at this present, Mr. Mike Ross, former senator.
Mm.
Okay.
And he's a Democrat.
Yes, sir.
Yes. So you say, I'm going to vote for the Democrats. So then they proceed to throw the lies about the Democrat at you, right?
They went quickly, and after a certain point, he went into negativism, the negatives against Mike Ross.
Right.
Primarily how he voted for this, he voted against that, he voted for this, against that, all in overall negativism.
Right. But they were all phrased as, would you still vote for him if you knew that, right?
Well, I didn't finish the call. Excuse
okay.
me. So when I perceived the negativism, I hung up. So, you know, that's how I ended it. But there is a, in my opinion, there is a concerted effort at grassroots level through ALEC.
I'm sure
you're familiar with
that. American Legislative Exchange Council,
I have contacted some of my local county, you know, ones that represent representatives.
Yeah, your state representatives.
And they have admitted, yes.
Yeah, the Republicans are almost all members of ALEC.
Yes, sir, and I saw that. I've seen the list, and overwhelmingly, Republicans we have in the Senate, the House, they're Republican.
Yeah, that's what ALEC is all about. It's about getting legislation passed in the states. And and the Koch brothers had a big meeting, by the way, over the weekend and over the last couple of days, and they said we're going to get even more active in politics as time goes forward. So get ready. Get ready. James, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV there in Arkansas. Lynn in Brighton, Colorado. Hey, Lynn, you had some examples of push polls.
Yes. How are you, Tom?
I'm fine. How are you?
Well, we're in a blizzard here, so but we'll get better.
Yeah.
So, okay, a push call was kind of a robocall from Mike Huckabee a couple years ago.
Uh-huh.
He was talking about the UN and how we should do away with it, and and then he started in on Obama, and I just kept listening and saying, oh, my God, oh, my God. And then at the end they said, if you'd like to talk to somebody, stay on the line. I said, oh, sure.
Mm-hmm.
So this poor little old woman who sounded like a retired little old lady, I just let her have it about the lies that were in this thing. I felt so bad for her. You know, I'm a Democrat, so I'm a loving, compassionate person.
Mm-hmm.
I felt so bad that she had to take a job like this, or maybe she was a volunteer. But I had my say. The other thing was kind of a push mailing that I got from Jim DeMint a couple years ago.
Yeah.
That was just full of lies.
Yeah. Well, he runs the Heritage Foundation now, so it's...
So I took the mailer, I wrote lie, I wrote BS all over it. I put it in the luckily enclosed self-addressed stamped envelope because he was asking for some money.
Mm-hmm.
I taped that envelope to a brick. I took it to the post office, and I said, they're going to pay for this at the other end. It's not just 42 cents or whatever the letter was. It was, you know, a, what, three-pound brick that they had to pony up some money for. And I told all my friends, if you ever get this nonsense, do that. So,
yeah, there you go. I don't know if the post office will let you do that anymore, but I've heard those stories. Lynn, thanks a lot. That's a great one. And, you know, I think one of the important things to remember, this is South Carolina where they're doing these push polls against Elizabeth Colbert Bush. It was South Carolina that where John McCain lost the primary in 2000, George W. Bush won it. And the only reason John McCain lost that primary, had he won that primary, it would have been McCain versus Al Gore in 2000. It wouldn't have been Bush versus Al Gore because McCain was on a winning streak at that point. And he lost because of a push poll that Karl Rove put together, apparently, that asked people if they would still vote for John McCain if they knew that he had an illegitimate African-American child. And the fact of the matter is that John McCain and his wife adopted a girl from Bangladesh. She has brown skin. And that, and they were running photos in the newspaper of this, and they were running ads on TV that showed him with his child, and then they push-polled saying, you know, would you vote for him if you knew? And it was a lie, of course. But he lost that election. This was in the Republican primary. The Republicans were horrified. Oh, my God, John McCain has an illegitimate black child? Are you kidding? In South Carolina? And now they're trying to do it again. Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle, you got a quick report for us on May Day activities?
Yeah, Tom, you know, we talked last year on May Day when there was a bunch of vandalism to a federal appeals court and some downtown corporate businesses. Well, this year I'm covering for Free Speech Radio News and some other people in the media consortium. And by the way, everyone should support Free Speech TV because Jefferson said a democracy needs a well-informed population.
Amen.
But downtown Seattle today, we have a huge police presence, and it actually began yesterday because last year there was that so-called May Day mayhem, which resulted in a federal grand jury, the jailing of four activists who were put in solitary confinement for 5 months, an internal and an independent review report on the Seattle police's activities during May Day last year, and also the resignation of our own Seattle Police Chief John Diaz. So there's a lot of attention today, a lot of focus on what's happening in Seattle. And that political fallout from last year, we're still debating, and the media is still covering it here locally.
But so far, it's been all peaceful and peace and love?
Yeah, there, like I said, there is a huge police presence. They're out in front of all of the downtown corporate businesses. But there are three different marches going on today, one at Seattle Central Community College later today. There's already been events happening at Westlake Center, which was the original Occupy Seattle encampment. And then there's also a big march by the El Comité, which is an immigrants' rights march, which has been going on for 20 years in Seattle.
Great.
And they're headed
Mark Taylor Canfield. You can read his writings over at Huffington Post and other places. Thank you, Mark.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's May 1st, May Day. Lots of different meanings to May Day. I mean, there are meanings that go back long before organized labor. The celebrations of the changings of the seasons and the beginning of the planting season and all that kind of thing. But it's also a period of time that or a day on which labor is honored. If that's the right word. Josh Idelson is with us, the labor journalist, contributing writer to The Nation and Salon. His website, Josh Idelson, EIDELSON.com. Josh, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back, Tom.
So your thoughts on Labor Day. What's the latest in the world of labor? What's going on?
So we're at a moment where we see unexpected vulnerability in the U.S. labor movement and unexpected vitality. There is no sugarcoating the fact that over the past few years, we have seen sites of historic strength, the birthplace of modern private sector unionism and the birthplace of modern public sector unionism in the U.S., become sites of devastating defeats. Michigan, Wisconsin, other states where Republicans have followed a similar lead. At the same time, we do see innovation in areas that have been historically non-union, where workers have faced tremendous obstacles in organizing. There has been a wave of one-day, non-union, low-wage worker strikes that have challenged industries that have seen very little labor mobilization, whether it's the fast food industry or retail, particularly at organized labor's biggest obstacle, Walmart.
Uh-huh. Okay. We were getting some feedback there. I think it was from your phone into your Skype system. It seems like your phone has dropped now. So would it be inaccurate to say that those places where we've seen the setbacks have been in the traditionally blue states that were very labor-friendly? The Michigan, Wisconsin, Michigan in particular just became a right-to-work-for-less state, where enormous amounts of Koch brother and similar kind of money were put in to get a Republican House, Senate, and governor in a Democratic state, in a majority Democratic state, so that they could flip those states and turn them into states like the rest of the right-to-work-for-less states, basically places of poverty.
There are a couple phenomena in play here. And in Michigan, as I noted at Salon, the key donors to the spinoff of the Republican Governors Association, whether you're talking about folks tied to the Koch brothers or the Kochs of Michigan, the DeVos family, all are people who have virulent anti-union records and have tangled with organized labor. And so following the money is important, and it demonstrates in part why we see this become a top priority for the Republican Party. At the same time, though, we should be clear, this is not only an elite phenomenon. It's not only a money phenomenon. The truth is that labor is also politically vulnerable. There is actual resentment against labor, not because unions have gotten too big, but because unions have gotten too small. As union density has precipitously declined in the United States to now below 7% in the private sector, it's created real vulnerability. And as I saw reporting for Salon in Wisconsin, it means that voters who a couple decades ago would have been family members of union members or in unions themselves now in some cases are more open to being told that getting the budgetary house in order requires taking a pound of flesh out of union members.
Yeah. Yeah. There has been this the meme that has been being put forward by the Republicans has been, look at these union members, they're making so much money, you know, and you're not making that much money. That's not fair. And instead of saying you should make more money, they're saying let's cut the union members, and particularly, you know, government union members, because they're, it's one of the last bastions of unionization. How is organized labor responding to that?
Well, there are places where we see labor in a defensive crouch. There are places where we see unions in tremendous danger, stirred to fight in places where they haven't fought. You look at a case like the lockout that went 20 months at the American Crystal Sugar Company. Those are workers who were not used to getting into big fights with the boss. I interviewed one of the workers who's become active around the lockout and asked, when were you guys active in the past? And she said, oh, when the company needed a tax break, we would mobilize to help the company get a tax break.
Hmm.
Workers were forced out because the company wanted to take away their health care, change it to a different system, go after their benefits. They tried a lot of the comprehensive campaign tactics that unions turn to now around politics, around the company's supply chain, around consumers and media, and those workers lost. There are places, though, where you see aggressive fight back, like over the past year, the strike that we saw in Chicago, where the Chicago Teachers Union, first, we saw a left-wing caucus fight within the union and take over and move the union in a different direction. And then because of strong community organizing, because of real partnership with parents and with neighbors, even when the national media turned against the strike from the beginning, we
and
saw
the Democratic mayor.
That's right.
And let's not forget.
That's right. They were up against the Democratic Party, the so-called liberal media, but they won because they had the parents on their side and because they were willing to use the strike weapon that unions so often neglect.
Yeah. This was really the biggest victory for labor of the year, don't you think?
It was one of the most important, in part because the assault on teachers' unions is one of the places where we see the most extreme form of the assault on organized labor in the United States, and it's one of the places where it is the most enthusiastically bipartisan. Teachers' unions are directly under attack from some of the leading politicians in both parties. And we see the two national unions walking a narrow line of not wanting to go too far and criticizing even Democrats who are openly calling for making it easier for their members to get fired. So the strike in Chicago defied, in some sense, not only Rahm Emanuel, but the Democratic Party, and not only the Democratic Party, but also the national leadership of the two teachers' unions. While people were publicly in support of each other, what happened in Chicago is charting a very different course for how you fight back against that attack than the more moderate one that we've seen from the national leadership, both of the AFT and of the NEA.
Right. How do you respond to Gar Alperovitz's critique of unions in his last book, in which he suggested that, Ronald Reagan declared war on unions. Arguably, you know, the Republican Party with Taft-Hartley in 1947 declared war on unions. The peak of unionization was in the early 50s at about 30%. And as you point out now, private sector union membership is below 7%. But that there are actually more people now who work for worker-owned cooperatives, in other words, who are owners of the companies that they work for, than there are members of unions in the United States, and that what we need to do is not so much be rebuilding the union movement, that that's something from the 19th and 20th century, but that instead we need to reinvent capitalism or even set aside capitalism and go with cooperativism or whatever you want to call this, you know, some new economic model that equally or maybe even in a greater way empowers workers. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, workers should have a voice in what the economic model is in society and in the workplace. You can't have a very robust form of democracy in the United States, in any country, if you don't have some kind of democracy in the workplace. Now, workers have sought that in different ways at different times. And right now, given the creaky, craven labor laws that we have, given the extent to which workers are explicitly excluded or just betrayed by labor law, you see various kinds of different formations, whether it's looking at a cooperative model or it's a question of workers organizing outside of collective bargaining under the law. But the question is, how do you power the
right. Josh, I'm sorry. Because you're coming in by Skype, as soon as the music starts, it just mangles the Skype. So, but thank you so much for being with us, Josh Eidelson. JOSHEIDELSON.com, the website, labor journalist and contributing writer for The Nation and Salon. Thanks so much. Good to be with us. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
16 minutes past the hour. Happy May Day. Happy the day on which we honor labor. We'll be back. Or a day on which we honor. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Three more people arrested with regard to the Boston bombing. And I wanted to get into some detail on this. Barry Nolan has been keeping his ear to the ground, doing some great reporting for us and others. He's a former reporter with WBZ Boston, now professor of journalism at Boston University, resident of Boston, and also now putting together documentaries like NoWayOutButOne.com. You can learn more about that there. Barry Nolan, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be with you.
Great to have you with us. So tell me, what's going on? Who are these people who got arrested in Boston, and what's their connection to the alleged bombers and the bombing, and how is Boston responding to this?
Boston is following the story really closely, but Boston is also just responding with a kind of defiance towards the whole notion of being terrorized. Down, if you go down onto Boylston Street to the area right where the bomb went off, today on a beautiful spring day like this, you'll find it thronged with shoppers, with people going purposefully to bring business to the shops that were so badly traumatized by the events of that marathon Monday. Boston's doing fine. These three young men that were arrested today, they're doing very badly. They were not in. It now appears that they were in no way involved in the planning. They didn't have foreknowledge of the bombing, because there's a text trail that Jahar left between himself and his three friends down at University of Massachusetts Dartmouth, and basically he told them, "Take anything from my room that you want. I'm out of here soon." Mm-hmm. And they apparently disposed of a backpack of his in the dorm room that contained a fireworks device that had been emptied of its gunpowder and a computer. So these guys are facing 5 to 8 years in federal prison. Best guess, if you were wanted to speculate, these guys will plea out. There were two of them from Kazakhstan. They will be deported. And the guy, there's an American citizen who will cooperate. And hard to tell exactly what will happen to him. Yeah. But I'm sure there will be a plea deal.
Does the evidence suggest that when they basically cleaned up, you know, the crime scene, as it were, after the fact, that they realized they were cleaning up a crime scene? Or were... had they put two and two together at the time that they disposed of this stuff, or were
apparently did text Jahar that, gee, you look like the guy in the picture. And he responded with some things like LOL. It's unclear. It will take a trial, and it will take a jury to determine whether or not they fully comprehended the full import of exactly what they were doing.
Yeah,
you can imagine that an old friend can call you up and say, "Hey, man, I'm going to be nailed for something I didn't do. You got to help me because I'm from Chechnya, I know they'll nail me even though I didn't do anything."
Right.
You can imagine,
especially if you're from Dagestan, if you're from a country that has equally not always, shall we say, civil yes. Liberties and whatnot.
Yeah. So. It's too early to begin elaborate speculation about exactly what they knew and what role they played and how knowingly they played their role.
Right.
But I think one of the things we did see today, sadly, was that there will be another casualty of the Boston Marathon bombing that could well be immigration reform. Already there's so many people on the far right that are using the fact that foreign people were involved in this, that Muslims were involved in this, that these people got welfare that it's playing so well on far-right radio
that
and you Fox. Can imagine that the way it rolls out is that this begins to be a drumbeat that begins to scare the Republicans that would have needed to support comprehensive immigration reform, and people may be badly wounded still by that bomb.
Yeah. On the other hand, the immigration reform bill that was being proposed had several giant booby traps in it. The main one being that the Republican border state governors had to certify that the fence was actually like the Berlin Wall, you know, that it was actually effective, and you know, which is by the way, incredibly destructive to the ecosystems of the Southwest. There are animals that need to migrate through those areas, but in any case, go ahead.
It's destructive to families. It's destructive to the ecosystem, and it is an issue for private people that believe in private property rights. The same people that are on the far right that think private property is sacrosanct now believe that to make the governor of Arizona happy, you have to take a lot of private property and put up a Berlin Wall.
Yeah, yeah, and that if that wall isn't I actually lived for a year on the East-West German border. I know what it takes to build a wall that will actually stop people. I've walked along that wall where the landmines were in the soil right next to, literally 3 feet from where I was walking, right on the edge of the road, and then 10 feet back from that, the 20-foot high barbed wire fence with the razor wire and the guys in the guard towers following with the machine guns. I've been there. And, you know, I know what it takes to build that kind of wall. So I think that this this attempt at reform was kind of booby-trapped to begin with. So maybe people will wake up in 2014 and we can get a decent Congress, and then we can take a serious shot at this. You know, but I think your point is well made. But
I think there if you want to try and game out the future.
Yeah.
It may well be that the immigration reform bill, as flawed as it would have been, will be a casualty of the Boston Marathon bombing, and that in turn will make the Republican Party a victim of their own devices. They will be hoist on their own petard in 2014 for opposing in this xenophobic way that you hear them talking about.
Right. How ironic is that, huh? Barry Nolan, former newscaster, WBZ-TV in Boston, NoWayOutButOne.com, professor of journalism at BU. Thank you, Barry.
Thank you, Tom.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Or I should say thank you, professor. We will be back 28 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 35 minutes past the hour. And by the way, I know of speaking of labor and jobs and things like that, I know of somebody who is looking for somebody for a short-term project, a researcher, somebody with a science background, with an actual degree in science. If you know somebody who has got a bachelor's or master's degree in science and can and therefore do good science literature searches. It's kind of a by-the-hour thing. It's a short-term project. But I know of an opportunity out there. So if you're such a person or you know such a person, have them drop an email to louise@tomhartman.com. And, just an FYI. So International Workers' Day, dirty tricks, push polls, the banks are saying, we got $700 trillion worth of debts out there. What could possibly go wrong? And we don't want to be regulated. We just don't want to be regulated, no. And here, this is a shocker. 29%, this is the headline over at TPM. 29% of Americans, according to a new poll, 3 in 10 registered voters, think that an armed rebellion might be necessary in the United States. I mean, I get these calls on this show, and I think to myself, you know, these are outliers. You know, these are very, you know, this that I must be hearing from the 1 in 1,000. No, I'm hearing from the, 1 in 3, or maybe arguably a little more than 1 in 4 Americans. It is truly mind-boggling. I mean, truly mind-boggling. I found this story fascinating. This was in The Guardian. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was arrested, held for 7 hours Monday, and warned to keep his mouth shut about matters detrimental to the Islamic regime before he was released, according to a source within the Revolutionary Guard's intelligence unit. Now, there's a presidential election coming up. This is all the more reason why we need to keep our nose out of Iran. Iran is a large, modern country, wealthy country. There is a large democracy movement in Iran. There's a lot of young people in Iran. They're well-wired and well-connected. The mullahs are old and dying. And the crazies like Ahmadinejad, you know, they try to play on nationalism, but they're being pushed out. And I just find this fascinating. I find it absolutely fascinating. And Bernie Sanders has come out and raised some questions about Tom Wheeler. Tom Wheeler, if you've never heard of Tom Wheeler is the guy. He was a lobbyist for two different telecommunications industries, most recently for the cable industry. And Barack Obama has appointed this lobbyist to be the head of the FCC. And he might be just the perfect guy for the job. Right? I mean, I was sharing with you a few minutes ago about, you know, how there's this, you know, Gary Gensler, who came out of the banking industry, and, you know, when he was put in charge of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, there were a lot of people who were going, oh, yeah, you know, wolf meat chicken house, right? But it turns out that he's doing a damn good job. He knows where the bodies are buried, and he knows who the actors are. So it might be a good idea, or maybe not. And Bernie wants to find out. So he says he's looking forward to the hearings. He's going to question Mr. Wheeler on this. Here's what Bernie said in a news release that he sent out today, and I'm sure he'll talk about this on Friday on the program on our Brunch with Bernie Hour. He said, in 1983, 90% of the American media was owned by 50 companies. Today, 90% of the American media is controlled by just six corporations: General Electric, News Corp, Disney, Viacom, Time Warner, and CBS. And in a move that could make that a bad situation worse, the FCC is considering whether to allow even more consolidation. And then he goes on about, you know, the whole TV, newspaper cross-ownership rule, all this stuff. He says, I am troubled that President Obama would appoint the former head of two major industry lobbying associations to regulate the industry. The head of the FCC should be looking out first and foremost for the public interest and may have to stand up to some of our nation's biggest media and telecom companies. I look forward to hearing from Mr. Wheeler regarding his views on media consolidation and other important issues that will come before the commission. We all do. Especially those of us in the media. It should be fascinating. Brian in Denver, listening on Denver's Progressive Voice, AM 760. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hi. I called because of the topic of labor as well.
Happy May Day.
I was just noting that after we had the anniversary in 2011 of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, and within 2012, we've seen tragedies that between the two of them, or just the one in Karachi, Pakistan, almost eclipsed the numbers.
Sure.
Between the two added together, we're talking close to 400 people in two garment factory fires.
Right. Well, and in America, on average, we have about 5,000 people a year who die on the job. Now, that doesn't, you know, we could do better than that. And in fact, there have been some calculations that just because of the sequester, at least several hundred more people will die as a result of companies being less oversight on companies by government organizations that ensure worker safety.
Well, it sounds like we may be going backwards, not just in regards to the overtime at all, but also early in the history in America when it comes to May and the Haymarket massacre, because they were talking about the eight-hour day back then.
Yeah.
And the overtime concept is related to that.
Yes.
Well, I mean, not even just related.
It is that.
It is that.
Yeah.
So I have a little speech difficulty there.
That's quite all right.
But it seems like one thing, one limited thing I just try to do is, and I'm not promoting myself because nobody will have any idea who I am through my real name, but just writing little blurbs, little songs, little poems about it, and remember the people did it before.
Mm-hmm.
Just to note it's happening, because it's easy to say when someone tries to say our product's not that explosive, what an explosion is like.
Right.
Describe it and have all kinds of onomatopoeia or whatever you want and put it right.
These guys had over 100 tons, over 100 tons of ammonium nitrate, if the news reports I'm reading are correct. That's mind-boggling. I mean, you know, it's like there wasn't supposed to be any. Brian, thank you. Very, very good on you, and keep up the great work. By the way, speaking of anniversaries, 10 years ago today, George Bush had an actual pilot fly him onto the aircraft carrier, the USS Abraham Lincoln, and he got out in his flight suit, you know, with the socks stuffed in there and everything, strutted around, and gave his mission accomplished speech. You know, combat operations, major combat operations are over. The Battle of Baghdad has been won, et cetera. I don't know if he used the word won, but, you know, it's that to that effect. It was a PR stunt 10 years ago today. At that time, 141 Americans and a couple of thousand Iraqis had died. Here we are 8.5 years later. Well, actually, 8.5 years later was the last combat veterans left. This is from a post over at Daily Kos. 4,488 Americans in uniform had lost their lives. 319 Allied troops. 1,500 contractors. And over 112,000 civilians in Iraq dead. 5 million displaced. And some suggest that the number of dead is over a million. And not only that, now because of all the depleted uranium we left in the country and the chemicals that we use that are you know, parts of the explosives, they themselves are toxic and mutagenic. We're having an epidemic of children being born with, like, you know, one eye in the middle of their forehead or no arms or, you know, a liver outside their body or a horrible spina bifida or, you know, on and on. Just the birth defects are just exploding in Iraq. We have devastated that country. And they've become an ally of Iran, and, you know, we were supposed to, I mean, this Bush did everything bin Laden wanted and everything the mullahs wanted. It is so mind-boggling. Anyhow, Kirk in Bothell, Washington, listening on 91.3 FM KBCS. Hey, Kirk, a minute to the break. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Happy May Day.
Thank you.
You know, I'm going to throw this out there. It's a very challenging and elusive goal, but I think labor's best hope is to organize globally.
Yep.
You remember the success of the Kone 2012 campaign and also groups like Anonymous and WikiLeaks. I think if you could sort of coalesce those two different social organizing tools, there's a possibility of making it happen. I've talked to you about WTO before, but the seeds were sort of planted there. There were representatives from trade labor unions from all over the world there, and it was an incredible feeling of solidarity, but it was brief, you know. It needs to be built into something that endures. And
yeah,
then it takes away.
I agree. I think we need to fundamentally be rethinking capitalism and our trade policies and our taxation policies, all of which have been skewed to help giant transnationals and screw labor. I mean, you know, let's just call it what it is. Wages, household wages, have basically remained flat since Reaganomics began, and individual wages have fallen. Thanks, Ronnie.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And really, you can't even just blame it on Ronald Reagan. I mean, Jimmy Carter started the whole deregulation craze 2 years earlier. He got infected by Maggie Thatcher, and Reagan just made it worse. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with Victoria Jones for all the news that's fit to print, as they say. News brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and, of course, the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hi, Victoria. Nice to see your smiling face.
Hi, Tom. So well, it is May Day, and while May Day may in Britain be synonymous with Morris dancing round the Maypole and much beer drinking. It is also, of course, the day for the workers. It is in Britain, too.
Mm-hmm.
And at his weekly general conference in St. Peter's Square in Vatican City today, Pope Francis spoke up for the workers. Said, and here I think of the difficulties that in various countries today afflict the world of work and business. He said, I think of how many, and not just young people, are unemployed, many times due to a purely economic conception of society which seeks selfish profit beyond the parameters of social justice. I wish to extend an invitation to solidarity to everyone, and I would like to encourage those in public office to make every effort to give new impetus to employment.
Wow. This is Pope Benedict. Let me add to that what he said.
Yes.
This was in a private mass today. He said, a headline that really struck me on the day of the tragedy in Bangladesh was, quote, living on 38 euros a month, end quote. He said that was what the people who died were being paid. This is called slave labor. Today in the world, this slavery is being committed against something beautiful that God has given us, the capacity to create, to work, to have dignity. How many brothers and sisters find themselves in this situation, not paying fairly, not giving a job because you are only looking at balance sheets, only looking at how to make a profit? That goes against God. Pope Benedict in a private mass today. Or Pope Francis, excuse me.
Pope Francis, yeah, pretty strong stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So anyhow, back to you.
Also today, three college friends of Boston Marathon bombing suspect Joakim Sonnev were charged with removing a backpack and fireworks from his dorm room or lying about it to the feds. Now, I'll try and get these names right. Two of them are Kazakhs. One is an American citizen. Azamat Tazayakov and Diaz Kadabayev appeared in court Wednesday, agreed to voluntary detention. They were the Kazakhs, already on immigration charges. And the third man, Robel Filipov, is charged with making false statements. These guys just seem to have been unbelievably stupid.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked with Barry Nolan earlier about this, you know, the former WBZ newscaster. He's been kind of keeping us up to date on what's going on in Boston. And they apparently texted to Joakim that you look like the guy in the picture. And he sent back a LOL, you know, but by the way, I'm leaving. Would you please throw my stuff away? And they did. And that wasn't such a good idea.
Yeah, they started to freak out. They realized he was wanted in the bombing. They decided collectively to throw the backpack and fireworks into the trash because they did not want Sarnev to get into trouble. This after, of course, they realized what the bombing meant and the number of people who were dead and injured. Quite astonishing behavior.
Yeah.
But then I don't know how old they are. If they're around 20, then people are stupid.
Yeah, well, you know, teenagers, young people, sometimes they're brilliant, and sometimes they just don't quite understand how the world works yet.
It's just bizarre. The Federal Bureau of Prison released a report to the Justice Department Inspector General today, a 91-page document that says the Federal Bureau of Prison's compassionate release program is poorly managed, clogged with delays that are very likely resulted in ill prisoners dying before their requests were completed.
Wow.
This is a compassionate release program, which basically is so that people who have a terminal incurable disease, life expectancy of 18 months or less, or a progressive incurable illness, or a debilitating injury, or completely disabled, or confined to bed or a chair more than 50% of their waking hours, they have the opportunity for this release. They found that, first of all, it could provide taxpayers with considerable savings by reducing the number of prisoners housed in the prison system. They said it doesn't give staff members clear guidance on the various medical and non-medical standards for considering release. There's no formal program to educate inmates about the release. Tens of thousands of inmates are ignorant. There are no established standards of timeline for how long it should take to review a request. So people are dying while their requests are being considered.
That's terrible.
quite astonishing.
It is.
Also today, Press Secretary at the White House, Jay Carney, said the White House is currently considering administrative actions President Obama can take to help push the process of closing the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, but he's ultimately going to need cooperation from Congress. They're considering reappointing a senior official at the State Department to renew their focus again on repatriating or transferring detainees that they determine could be returned to their own countries or third countries. Bear in mind that they made the decision to close the State Department office that had the responsibility for doing that in the first place.
The Obama administration did.
Yes.
Yikes.
So it's,
now, this was not a matter of Congress cut the funding. It was the a matter of the Obama administration just said, nah. Wow.
That's kind of one of those, really.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, and they're also going to work to fully implement the periodic review board process, which has not moved forward quickly enough, and then he put the blame on Congress for circumscribing their ability to move on it. Also, turns out, just thought you might be interested in knowing this, Jamestown settlers, 8 people.
Yeah, I saw that report from National Geographic. A 14-year-old girl had apparently been eaten by some of the other people at Jamestown during that horrible winter of, what was it, 1409?
Yes, 1609. Yeah. They ate her face.
Yeah. They ate her brain.
Brains and face, delicacies at that time.
Were they?
Yes, they liked boar's heads, pig's heads and things, and thought it was nice.
Oh, my. Well, live a little, learn a little. Victoria Jones.
Yes.
Thank you very much for the report today.
Thank you.
Always great to hear your voice. The Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. We will be back with Brian Fisher, who wants to talk about...
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And we have this... I find this so extraordinary, this story of Mr. Collins coming out as being an openly gay NBA basketball star for years and years, and he says I've pretty much worked with everybody. And there was a story, where did I say, I was just reading this a minute ago, this about rats. Hang on just a second here. One of the NFL, here we go, Wisconsin Church, an NFL player, Leroy Butler, he's a former safety for the Green Bay Packers. He was going to give an anti-bullying presentation in a Wisconsin church this summer, and because he tweeted out, congratulations, Jason, for coming out, the church canceled his anti-bullying talk. And when he said to the pastor, well, I guess, we can agree to disagree on this, the pastor replied, no, I'm right and you're wrong. It's like, oh, really? Isn't that bullying? I'm not sure. Let's ask Brian Fisher. He's the host of Focal Point Radio Show on AFR Talk, the director of Issues Analysis for Government and Public Policy, the American Family Association, AFA.net. Brian, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be back with you.
Great to have you. Are you really worried about gay players in locker rooms? I mean, this is the note I have here. What did she just yell?
Well, I would say that would be a greater concern to NBA basketball players and NBA owners.
Well, what's your concern?
I don't have a concern. That's up to NBA owners and players.
Oh, okay. Well, all right.
I do think it's a mistake that his homosexuality is being celebrated as it is. And speaking of anti-bullying protections, I think we need that for Chris Broussard.
trashed him on ESPN, saying that he was abominable, or words to that effect.
No, he said homosexuality is a sin according to the Bible.
Yeah.
And he's been bullied for that.
Yeah, so is eating shellfish, you know.
Sorry.
Should we go after Red Lobster?
I'm not following you.
In Deuteronomy, in the same place where it says that homosexuality is an abomination, it also says eating shellfish is an abomination. They're equal abominations. Should we be trashing Red Lobster?
Well, again, Tom, I'm a Christian, so the New Testament is the guiding document for me.
Okay, well, where in the New Testament did Jesus trash homosexuality? My recollection is that during the Last Supper, John spent most of the meal with his head on Jesus' chest, so much so that when Peter had a question about who was going to betray Jesus, he couldn't ask Jesus because John had his head on his chest. He had to ask John, quote, the disciple who Jesus loved, end quote, to ask Jesus the question.
So you're suggesting that John and Jesus were male lovers?
I'm suggesting that John and Jesus were close enough physically to each other that you probably would have been nervous.
Are you suggesting they were homosexual lovers?
No, I'm not.
Okay, good. We agree on that.
I'm suggesting, however, that they were physically close enough to, and, you know, John might have been gay and not acting it out. I don't know, or that might have just been the standard of the time. But the point is, if you say, you know, if you're going to base, you know, trashing homosexuality on the New Testament, it ain't in there. But, you know, what is, if you go to GodHatesFigs.org, I think, you know, so much of this new the Baptist church, whatever it is, you know, the Westboro Baptist church, you know, that's running around with their God's Hate Fag stuff, it's a typo. You go to GodHatesFigs.org, and you could read Jeremiah 29:17, where God trashes a fig tree. Psalms 105:33, where he trashes a fig tree. Matthew 21:18, Jesus trashes a fig tree. Jeremiah 24:2, God trashes a fig tree. Actually, figs in this case, not a tree. A whole basket full of figs. And in Luke 13:8, where Jesus again trashes figs. But I don't find any reference to gays in the New Testament. Do you?
Oh, yeah. Romans 1, 1 Corinthians 6, 1 Timothy 1, all over the place.
Wait a minute. You're talking about where Paul, I believe it was, said some men are born eunuchs, some choose to be eunuchs, and some are made eunuchs. Wasn't he basically acknowledging that some men are born not attracted to women?
Well, Jesus is one that made the comment about eunuchs, Tom. Paul in Romans 1 said homosexual behavior.
Oh, you're right. It was Jesus who said it, who acknowledged homosexuality. And not in a condemnatory way.
Is unnatural.
Here's what baffles me, Brian. There is a virtual industry of men who sit around all day thinking about gay men and worrying about them, and I don't think that normal straight men do that. What's the deal?
Tom, I will be happy to stop talking about homosexuality just as soon as you do.
Okay. All right. Well, in that case, we'll wrap it up. Brian Fisher, AFA.net, the host of Focal Point, the Focal Point radio show on AFR Talk. Brian, thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome, Tom.
Okay, good talking with you. That was interesting. It's interesting. We'll see where that goes, and I don't know where that goes. But this whole idea of Jason Collins coming out and being trashed by the religious right, actually, I guess I'm not going to stop talking about it. I'm going to talk about it for another minute or two. I just think that the whole homophobia industry is being driven by people who want us to be afraid. And, you know, whether it's afraid, it used to be afraid of black people. And I mean, it still is in many quarters. Or be afraid of Muslims. Or be afraid of gay people. And, you know, these are all levels of intolerance that I think are just fundamentally un-American, anti-American. And I think that we should be celebrating Jason Collins. And I think that, you know, the comments to the effect that, you know, that he's doing this because it's the end of his career and whatnot. This was the note that Brian Fisher had sent us before we went on the air. I don't buy that stuff. It's going to be really interesting to see. You know, I mean, he's a free agent. Who picks him up next year? But This is, I think, a turning point. I think we're seeing a couple of really significant turning points right now, culturally, socially. I think that we're going to see, I think, first of all, we're seeing the acceptance of the entire LGBT community, which, you know, includes transgendered people as well. Let us not forget. They're very rarely discussed, but, you know, a very important part of that community. The acceptance of that. And I think we're going to see, and I realize the two have nothing to do with each other at an obvious level, but I think we're going to see the decriminalization of pot in the next 5 years. And I think what's happening is that, you know, the liberals have always said, you know, let gay people get married and let people, you know, be themselves. And, you know, why do we have these stupid drug laws? But now you've got this generation of young people who call themselves conservatives, but actually are calling themselves libertarians. They don't understand economics particularly well. If they did, they wouldn't call themselves libertarians or conservatives. The billionaires have, you know, snookered them pretty well on the economics end of it. And the way that the billionaires are pulling these young people in is by saying, you know, on the social issues, we're cool. Yeah, smoke pot. Gay people can get married, things like that. And it's dry. And not just that, but I think, you know, just a general maturity in our society is driving a positive change. And I'm very pleased with that. I really am. 15 minutes past the hour. If you want to talk about Jason Collins and the NBA and all that sort of thing, you're welcome to. A lot of other things in the news. I think what Pope Francis said today is vital.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
He said, not paying fairly goes against God. Speaking of God, the Pope. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Donald in Aurora, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Hey, Donald, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You know, I'm a Roman Catholic, and I was raised in a Catholic grammar school. I mean, I was educated in Catholic grammar school and Catholic high school. I can't deal with the Bible thumpers anymore. They seem to have a certain arrogant attitude, like they're so self-righteous. They take passages of the Bible and they seem to interpret it to support their own twisted convictions. They not only do that, but you know something? I'm getting to the point where I'm tired of religions, because it seems to be that sometimes religions become a conviction, so you can get away with not feeling guilty of any wrongdoings that you do to other people. All you got to do is confess your sins. At least that's the way I was taught as a Roman Catholic.
Yeah. We can talk about that aspect of and it's not unique to Catholicism, by the way. It's pretty much right across the board in Christianity. I believe in redemption, and I also have a problem with the idea that you can go out and kill somebody and then the next day suddenly everything is fine, at least between you and God. But the larger issue is, frankly, I think, Donald, that what's going on is not religion. It's bigotry, and it's bigots who are using religion to justify it. And I mean, they used to use the Bible to justify slavery. The Mormon Church, up until 1978 or 87, wouldn't allow black people in the church because they said that was the mark of Cain, that in Genesis, you know, Cain was marked on his forehead, and so that all people could identify him and shun him before he was thrown out of the Garden of Eden and went off and married a girl in the next town over, which is like, oh, wait a minute, where did she come from? But in any case, you know, after he killed Abel. And slavery was justified as being biblical. And Paul in the Bible says, treat your slaves well. Okay, gee, should we go back to slavery? I mean, if we're going to be all New Testament and Paul says, treat your slaves well. So Donald, I think that it's not so much religion that is at fault as, you know, us fragile human beings or the bigoted human beings among us who are, thank you for the call, by the way, who are using religion as a way of, you know, basically pushing this kind of stuff. Anyway, Howard in Hollywood, Florida. Hey, Howard, what's up?
Hey, so you're really serious about the sun not going around the earth?
I have not seen a survey, a study on this in a long, long time, but it would be fascinating to do a man-in-the-street survey where you just walk up to 20 or 30 people and say, does the earth revolve around the sun or does the sun go around the earth? I'll bet you would get a different ratio of answers in the United States than you would in Europe.
Well, that's not why I called.
Okay.
Classic remark. I've got an irrefutable argument against religionists for being gay. Simple word, hermaphrodite.
Okay, a hermaphrodite is a person who is both male and who has both male and female genitals, characteristics, abilities?
Yes.
Yeah, genitals. Yeah.
Yes, and obviously made by God. By definition, whichever way this person goes automatically makes them gay.
Yeah, okay. Or a simpler way to say it, Howard, would be to say, does God make mistakes if people are made gay? If you want to use the religious argument, I'm not all that fond of using religious arguments, but, and Howard, thanks for the call. But that's why I bought the URL godhatesfigs.org to suggest, which takes you to a page on my website where I've got all these places where God is smiting figs as a way of talking back to the Westboro Baptist Church. But in any case, Tina in Jay, New York, you got a robocall?
That's what this whole thing started with. But my goodness, I have compiled a list of more interesting things.
You've been on hold for a while.
Happy birthday. I got a robocall, I guess it was around 2010, and I was just so irate because it was such a rude call, I called my congressman. And I have not gotten a robocall since.
Well, that's good.
But yeah. I wanted to just quickly throw tidbits, and I mean quickly. First of all, thank you for broadcasting a theory I have espoused for a couple of decades now about the inverse relationship between the phallically challenged and violence and anger. I purported that for ages. In fact, I mentioned it to Danielle months ago.
Between the what challenged?
I want to say that one in four Iraqi children
now are phallically challenged. Oh, phallically challenged, yes.
Yes, phallically challenged.
Yeah, the smallpenisgunclub.com.
Yes.
Yes.
But I wanted to say that one in four children in Iraq that survive are stunted. I want to say that in the last decade, at one point, there was more plastic surgery in Tehran than Beverly Hills. I wanted to say that in South America, there was more support for the Walmart workers trying to unionize that one day late last year than in this country. And I wanted to say, happy almost birthday. Please, you and your staff, come to my home. I'll make you a lovely vegetarian meal, good coffee, good wine if anyone wants it, and good conversation.
I'll take that. Thank you, Tina, for the very kind offer. And by the way, we could just about cut our carbon emissions worldwide in half if everybody in the world became vegan. So, step one. But Tina, thank you for the call. It's very kind of you, and thanks for mentioning the phallically challenged among us. I do think that the smallpenisgunclub.com and .org, they point to different places, and .net. This website is going to come up shortly. The Small Penis Gun Club they're growing. So right here on the program that is Viagra for your brain. We will be back. It is 27 minutes past the hour. Oh, man. Okay, we got to get back to just rational stuff. Republicans want to eliminate your overtime pay. I'll tell you about that after the break. We'll pick up your calls.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Yes, seriously. The Republicans said this. Paul Ryan had this idea. Let's cut out overtime pay for working women, and they're actually pushing this thing. I'll tell you about it after the break. The very, very Aristarchianly ugly, the good. The anti-smoking campaign, according to a new study from the Center for Disease Control, youth education programs on the negative health effects of cigarettes have a strong impact on whether or not an individual will take up smoking later in life. The researcher, which pooled together findings from 134 different studies from across the globe, traced the behavior of kids starting at ages 5 through 8 who developed smoking habits after never previously smoking. The researchers found that over time, those children exposed to anti-smoking programs were significantly less likely, than their peers to use cigarettes again. Although most of the studies used focused on the U.S., the research as a whole represents the most comprehensive evidence yet of the importance of cigarette education. Knowledge is power indeed. The bad. Michelle Malkin. During a Tuesday appearance on Fox News, conservative pundit Michelle Malkin blasted Attorney General Eric Holder for worrying about the phantom epidemic of hate crimes against Muslims.
What is the first instinct of the Justice Department after that event? No, not to name jihad, Islamic jihad, as the enemy and threat to public safety in America. But no. He talked about these phantom threats of hate crime epidemics that have never happened.
Yeah, actually, Michelle, hate crimes against Muslims are a huge problem. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, the past 3 years have seen the highest spike in reported anti-Muslim violence since the 9/11 attacks. There were 160 attacks in 2010 and 157 in 2011. And considering the amount of Islamophobia pumped out of Fox so-called news in recent weeks, those numbers are likely to grow even higher. Too bad Fox so-called news is more interested in fanning the flames than covering the real threats to American citizens. And the very, very ugly... The CNBC host who went on one of his trademark rants yesterday, dismissing the sequester cuts as irrelevant and mocking the unemployed.
This general agreement, this will reduce GDP growth by 1.5 percentage points and result in 500,000 to 700,000 fewer jobs. Now,
You know what, Steve? Why is that so important? If you want to put those people to work, put pro-growth policies, not socialism, in place.
All right, that's Rick Santelli. This is the guy who many credit with kicking off the Tea Party with his big anti-Obama rant back in 2009. Make no mistake about it, this is the cold, soulless heart of the Tea Party. And that is just very, very ugly. Well, he's also a stockbroker guy. I mean, it's like, gee. Okay, this Working Families Flexibility Act, this is what I promised I would tell you about before the break. The Working Families Flexibility Act, they are advertising this. This was originally a Paul Ryan brainchild. It would remove the requirement to pay someone time and a half for time over 40 hours a week. And they're promoting it on websites that are frequented by women. It is going to be promoted as you no longer have to choose between work and your family. And it's like, we're going to give you the ability to have flex time. Well, employers already have the ability to offer flex time to their workers. And workers already have the ability to, you know, negotiate that with their employers. But this is like giving up a federally protected right. And it's bizarre. It's just bizarre. But it was Paul Ryan's idea, so what do you expect, right? Seraphim in Mountain View, California. Hey, what's up?
Hello, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great. What's on your mind?
Hey, I just wanted to... I'm sorry, just was on speakerphone here. I just wanted to let you know that there is some people out here who get tired of how the status quo goes with regards to our work schedules and stuff, and take another look at the labor laws and come up with interesting stuff. Here, especially in California, there's a lot of stuff tied to the Industrial Welfare Committee, which sets a lot of the type of positions up in terms of blue-collar and white-collar workers and whether they should be paid hourly or exempt. Mm-hmm. And I worked in Silicon Valley. I've worked in Silicon Valley for about 25 years in a tech support role and seen a lot of different changes. But one of them is a tendency for employers to say, okay, you're in tech support. You're supporting a technical product, so we're going to call you a professional and we're going to pay you exempt, when in fact – What we're doing is a break-fix job. We follow the manual. We follow the troubleshooting guides. We follow what the engineers and escalation folks tell us, right, to repair the product. So we don't create anything. We don't consult. We don't design.
We're you have no control over your own workplace, basically.
Yeah, it's all over creativity.
Yeah.
And IWC4, which is the fourth rule that says, you know, how tech support people and certain white-collar people are treated, you know, makes a differentiation between the professionals that do, you know, code and create hardware and all this other stuff
right.
versus the you know, the worker bees who just maintain it and make sure the customer
right.
understands how to work it. And
Serafin, what's your point?
It's broken.
That this
point
is, that is this is a way in Silicon Valley that they're screwing, another way that they're screwing workers?
You got it. By calling the tech support workers who are the worker bees exempt and screwing us out of overtime, one of the big points for it that you're making today, and also holiday pay, et cetera. But you can get a lawyer, you can sue for it, and you can win.
Okay. Serafin, thanks a lot for the call. It is amazing, the state of labor in the United States, just in general. By the way, I had forgotten for a moment what I was – but Louise had asked me to mention. I mentioned earlier in the previous hour that we know of a project that it's just a few-week project, but it's we're looking for somebody who has a degree in science, who understands the scientific method, who can research scientific literature online. And please send resume, you know, a resume, writing samples, and some research samples to Louise at Tom Hartman, T-H-O-M Hartman, Hartman with two N's .com. If you or you know somebody who would qualify for that, this is a by the hour kind of job, and it's just a short term project, but it is, you know, hey. Offering a gig here. Mike in LaPorte, Indiana, listening to WCPT. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Mike.
Happy Labor Day.
Yeah.
And for us in Indiana, the story for Labor Day is one that's not being reported in the national news, but it has gotten a little coverage in the local news. 10 steelworkers at the ArcelorMittal Burns Harbor plant shut down the two of the largest blast furnaces in the world, and they're still shut down for a week. And the basis of the complaint was, it was a safety complaint because they had cut the crews so far that they couldn't maintain a safe workplace. So 10 of the key operators in the slab caster decided to go home rather than work. That shut down the slab caster and the BOF, and since the blast furnace feeds that, they had no place to put the iron.
Right.
So the blast furnaces went down, and because some really stupid management didn't know what to do in this situation and thought that it would get settled quicker, they let the molten iron solidify in a lot of the transporting vessels. They call them torpedo cars. And now they've got a real mess, and they don't know when they're going to start up again. And yet it's a big secret as far as the national media is concerned. I haven't heard a word about it.
I have not seen it covered anywhere. Mike, thanks for sharing the story with me.
I haven't. And I've sent out the story to everybody that I know, but I don't know that many people with a voice. So that's why I called you.
Yeah, well, thank you. You know, I was sitting on an airplane on my way to Portland on whatever day of the week it was. I can't keep track of time. A couple days ago, I think it was Friday. And it was one of these new 737s where they've got the screen in front of, you know, on the back of the seat in front of you. And the whole plane was tuned to CNBC. And they had their Mad Money show, not the one with Jim Cramer. There must be a new one. I haven't watched CNBC in years, but this was, it was called Fast Money or whatever it was. But they had, you know, a kind of a reporter, and then they were like, you know, bang, 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 fast interviews and you know, and they were like, okay, what about this company? Oh, this company is, you know, their earnings are so-and-so. They got a new product coming out, so we think that, you know, their stock at this is probably going to go up. And then, well, what about this company? Well, that company is doing it. And it was like, for the hour and a half that it took to fly from D.C. to Chicago, I'm watching this show because there's nothing else to do on the airplane. And I was sort of half watching. I was also trying to read a novel on my phone. But what kept occurring to me was this could just as easily be a labor show. This could be a show in which you get a whole bunch of labor people together and you say, okay, which company right now is paying well? Which company is really screwing their workers? Who's trying to stop a labor organizing effort? Who is, you know, who's doing well with their labor efforts? What unions are coming up now? Which unions are coming down now? Are there unions who are merging? Are there unions who aren't? How is the labor situation with regard to this company going to, you know, and if it was done in the same way, same fast production values, same, you know, good, you know, wide variety of guests, good interviews, a what's in it for me kind of part, because this was, you know, for people who want to invest in stocks. So it'd be more like, you know, hey, we're all part of America. How do we make America better? How do we, you know, it just occurred to me, this could be a TV program. And that reminded me of the fact that when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s and 70s, we had labor sections in our newspapers. In fact, my Uncle King was the editor of the newspaper for Motor Wheel, which was the big, you know, company in Lansing that manufactured the wheels for cars. And it was a labor newspaper that was paid for and sponsored by the company, but put together by the union. And my brother just sent me some copies of it. I think there's such a possibility here, and we just never talk about labor. We really should. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But we, obviously, I'm talking about the whole corporate media machine. I mean, there is no... everybody knows about stock prices. Everybody knows what the NASDAQ is doing. Nobody knows what the average wage is. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 10 minutes before the hour, Dave in Quakertown, Pennsylvania, listening on Sirius XM. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on. First, I want to throw in a plug there. I want to say everybody, happy May Day or International Workers' Day. Today's May 1st. And, so I wanted to share that. And second, my question is in regards to you, actually. For the gentleman that called in and was against using the Bible as a valid argument against, you know, gay rights. Mm-hmm. I don't understand. I mean, I'm very thankful that you actually had the opportunity to rebut him with actual Bible verses. But, you know, I think the reality is that we enable them to use that as an argument by thinking that it's an actual argument when in fact it's irrelevant in
there's 536 or 563 or 356 or 653 it's got those numbers in it, right? The list of rules for conduct that you'll find in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. And among them, that you can't wear clothing made out of two different kinds of fabric. And there are some observant Jews who continue to follow this. You know, the Hasidim. You know, their clothing is entirely made out of cotton, for example, or linen, or whatever it may be, or wool. It's only a single fabric. That you cannot eat shellfish. Shellfish are not kosher. I mean, there's people who follow the kosher rules. And, you know, so there is this whole long set of rules, and not being gay was sort of one of them. Not masturbating was one of them. But, you know, really, are we really going to base a society on a set of rules that were supposedly handed down to some enlightened individual by a Bronze Age god, you know, 3,000 years ago? Really?
Well, yeah, definitely. That's my point. You know, you should point out to them that their argument is essentially irrelevant because only they believe in that fictitious book made of paper, and most other people don't.
Yeah.
So therein lies it's not an actual argument.
Thomas Jefferson, when he was talking about, you know, the Constitution, he said, "We had no need to turn to dusty books and ancient scripture. We looked in our hearts and we found the laws of nature engraved there." In other words, morality is not something that you need from the Bible. In fact, you know, most of the several of the Ten Commandments are not even law in a lot of places. Certainly blasphemy, which is the first commandment, is not against the law in most places. And yet, or worshiping the wrong God. There are these people who think that you have to have religion to have morality. I think morality preceded religion. All over the world, you find indigenous people who've never, ever heard of monotheism or religion or anything like that. They may have their own version. They may be pantheistic. They may be polytheistic. They may be atheistic. And they are every bit as moral, and in some cases, I would argue, far more moral than the people who are the people of the book, the monotheists. So, Dave, thanks for the call. Good point. Charles in Montgomery, Illinois. Hey, Charles, what's up? Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Hi, Tom. I had a theory that maybe a municipality could just pass a law for the strict reason of fighting it all the way to the Supreme Court, basically taking the argument that, and say, making a law that corporations are people and that money is speech.
Money is not speech.
I know that, but...
Oh, you mean pass a law refuting Citizens United, that a community could do that? That's being done. It's being done right now, Charles. There's a group called the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDF. Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDF.org is their website, CELDF.org. Thomas Lindsay is their head guy. He's an attorney. He has helped over 150 communities pass laws saying in our town, and he's got a couple hundred more that are on the edge of it, on the verge of it, that in our town, corporations do not have personhood. They do not have rights, and money is not speech. And they've been doing it to do everything from stopping industrial hog farm operations to just this last week, they had a city that banned oil and gas extraction and fracking. Not a city, a county, an entire county that did it. So say what?
Basically.
Oh, yeah. It's on. I had him on TV last night. If you go to YouTube.com/TheBigPicture, or just go to TomHartman.com, you can watch the YouTube of my interview with Thomas Lindsay where he laid it out. So, Charles, you are on it. You are right, absolutely on top of it. So, good on you. Josh in Charlotte, North Carolina, listening serious. Hey, Josh, what's up?
Oh, good afternoon. I think you were dead on about the homophobia industry,
mm-hmm.
but being gay myself, I've seen it all the way back to when I could remember Anita Bryant and all that.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's whatever is politically or financially expedient for these people. It's Fred Phelps at the Westboro Baptist Church.
Right.
The only time he gets any attention is when he has his people out with God Hates Fags and
right.
and protesting the funerals of servicemen, so on and so forth. And, of course, it's just another brand of snake oil.
You know, somebody, Josh, I don't disagree with you. I think that there is a homophobia industry, and I think that there are some people who just, like, literally make a living off it. But the other day somebody asked Fred Phelps if he himself had any... gay thoughts towards other men, if he had ever found other men attractive. And he went nuts. He went absolutely ballistic. And I think that there are, and I think this is dying out, but I think this is a generational thing, but I think that there are some people like Fred Phelps who probably actually was born gay and repressed it so hard and pushed it down so deep that he spends his whole life obsessing about homosexuality because he's gay. And yet he can't acknowledge it, and so he's got to fight it. Does that make sense to you?
It makes sense, but you might have a lawsuit on your hands.
What, from Fred?
From Fred.
Oh, that would be great.
Nonetheless, it's just whatever flavor of the day, whatever boogeyman is there. We must fight the boogeyman together. Therefore, you must line the collection plates so we'll have the resources to do so.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, your perspective on it is a little more economic and cynical. Mine is a little more psychological. We're probably both right. Josh, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. Appreciate it. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman Program, the latest news and information you need to win the water cooler wars. You know, there's a new push to fix the filibuster. I'm going to tell you all about that. Plus, my favorite segment of the week, Geeky Science. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Go to movetoamend.org. Go to pdamerica.org. Go to celdef.org, celdf.org. Go to free-don.com. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.